Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost.
Yeah, we did. We bought the apple. We also bit the apple, and the garden was lost. And so we had to learn to pay the cost burning too many things: fossil fuels, nuclear power, paper ballots, electronic voting machines. And we have with us a fabulous guest, the great Lila Garrett of KPFK in California, to talk about all of this with us. Lila, are you with us?
I'm with you.
All right, Sarah, it's great to have you. You are. How long have you been at Talk Host there at KPFK?
Oh, I didn't hear that question. What was it?
How long have you been at
I've been there for 13 years, and I have to tell you something. While I was holding on for you, Harvey, I heard some of your promos on your station, and one woman came on and said, listen to my Connect the Dots, and she proceeded to describe it as kind of a health show, I think. And that's the name of my show, Connect the Dots, and it's been my show for 13 years. I don't know, is that allowed? I mean, my show is, I didn't know the shows were allowed to have the same name. But
I don't know. Well, I think that should be allowed, yeah. So your show is Connect the Dots. You do political work. You're
right.
A great host, a wonderful person to talk to, and you have been covering politics in a very unique and powerful way for a long, long time. And so let's get right down to it here.
Okay.
You get to vote in California, which, of course, is going to go for Hillary Clinton. But based on our many conversations and dinners together, we know that you are not a big fan of Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, tell us what you think about Donald Trump.
Well, you know, Donald Trump is sort of a demented child. You know, he continues to dominate the media. He's been dominating the media for really 2 years because he lives by the old Hollywood adage, I don't care what you say about me in the press, just spell my name right.
Right.
Excuse me. So he really understands the value of publicity. And the press has obliged. So if he becomes our president, God forbid, the press can thank itself for that, because Donald Trump just reeks of mediocrity, to put it kindly. You know,
what do you mean by that?
Well, he lies all the time. He's not really informed. He has a very limited vocabulary. What drives him is a competitiveness that knows no bounds. I tell you, I'm looking at the New York Times now, and that is so beautifully presented in the New York Times. And I'll tell you, what will we do with the New York Times, frankly? And it talks about the fact that when he built Trump Towers in 1979, this is unbelievable, he was disturbed by the fact that the General Motors building was higher than his building. So he said, my building looks a little small. And he said to the architect, now this is once the building's been built, he said to the architect, can we make my building taller? So they went through it, you know, the walls and so on, and they recognized that they could not make his building taller, and they could also not make the General Motors building shorter. So what he did was he came up with a brilliant idea, which a lot of buildings have used since. He decided to call the first floor the 30th floor, and the building went up from there. And then he said, well, we have, 40 floors more than the General Motors building, so that makes us bigger. So when I talked to him about a demented psychopathically competitive child. You know what I mean?
Well, what do you think we can do about him? I mean, what's going to happen with Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, we're reading all kinds of discouraging reports, and there are a variety of reports. It's not as though anyone, everyone agrees that he is soaring in the polls. I just looked at my computer, and I saw that it was just reported by the Washington Post that he is just 2 points behind Hillary Clinton nationally at the moment. And there is something about him that makes the country respond. There was something about Hitler that made the country, the working class, respond. It was frustration. It was, and with frustration comes, a new surge of prejudice. Anyone who does not look like me must go, that kind of prejudice. And so much undirected anger that he represents to people like that, someone who is against the establishment, someone who isn't afraid to say what's on his mind. The problem is, what mind? You know, what does Donald Trump really stand for? I think the fact that he constantly says about the Middle East, well, if they don't like what we're doing, we'll bomb the blank out of them. You know, this is his solution. He does say some comforting things. He says he is friendly with Putin. He forgets. He said he's never met him. He's never talked to him on the phone. But the bottom line is that he forgets that he said he had a wonderful conversation with Putin on the phone. That was months ago. And that the man couldn't have been more polite and more friendly and more charming. He actually said that. Then last week I heard him say he has never spoken to Putin. He has no respect for truth at all. But he does say that it doesn't hurt to be friendly with Russia, does it? And, you know, it doesn't. He's right about that. We don't need to re-inflame Russia. We don't need to do that again. And both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have decided to do that, that the United States needs an enemy, a permanent enemy, a cold war, in order to unify our country around them. And that's what they did a few years ago. They realized that they weren't getting any mileage in terms of unifying our country by attacking the Middle East relentlessly. And they said, we have to go back and vilify Russia. And that's what they did. And that's what they're still doing. So I think Trump has gotten mileage from that. And he's right about the fact that we don't need, that NAFTA was a bad thing. And that there are one or two other ways in which he's right.
He has made some pretty piercing comments about NAFTA and about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes, he has. He has. But, you know, when he talks about business, I don't see anything different that he would be doing. He might not give the signatories an agreement like the Trans-Pacific Partnership as much free rein as the TPP gives corporations. But it's the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, actually hands government over to the corporations. They become government. They do not have any restraints. There are no restrictions. There are no rules. There are no regulations in the TPP. They decide, corporations decide what's safe. And if they lose any profit by being constrained by a government, they can sue the government for the money that they would have made if those constraints weren't there. So the TPP hands everything over to the corporations. Well, you know, that's not what Donald Trump has been objecting to. His objections to the TPP are very vague. I think he feels that the United States doesn't have enough power in the TPP, that other countries have power, even Korea has power, Mexico has power. We don't have enough power in the TPP as far as he's concerned. What do you think motivation?
It's political. I mean, he couldn't care less, really, I don't think. And, of course, we know that NAFTA has been a complete catastrophe. And, it has gutted what was left of our industrial core. And, of course, that has had horrible impacts on our cities. And the TPP, as far as I can tell, would be worse. And you're right. You're exactly right. It gives over power in everything, pretty much everything, to the corporations.
Right. So the corporations become the government. The dictators of the world. And he's also, Trump is also against NATO, and many of us are too, because NATO can only exist if there's war, if you have allies and enemies, and they want to exist. So when they don't have enemies, they create them. And but that's not, that. You see, Trump is against it, but not for those reasons. He's against it because the members of NATO each have as much power as the United States. And that's not what he wants. What he wants is world domination. That's what he wants. And he's against anything that doesn't provide that. So as a person, as someone who tried to make Trump Tower taller than the General Motors building by naming the first floor the 30th floor, he doesn't sound to me like a substantial leader or like one that's at all safe. In addition, the people he's appointed so far are monsters, absolute monsters. And he will really give the hard decisions up to these monsters. I mean, Mike Pence is worse than Trump. He's privatized everything he possibly could in his state. He's virulently against choice. I think that Trump says he's against choice, but I remember when he was for it. He has no convictions, Harvey. What's your opinion of him?
I think he's Mussolini, basically. He's Berlusconi. He's a fascist who will say pretty much anything and use scapegoating, racism, violent language, horrible contempt for women, obviously, to do whatever the hell he wants. I hated his programs. I couldn't stand even 5 minutes of The Apprentice, and I always just thought he was a complete jerk. And he's a complete jerk. So here's the more complex question, Lila Garrett, the host of Connect the Dots on KPFK in Los Angeles. What about Hillary?
Well, Hillary's a problem too, but she's a mixed bag. I mean, she's intelligent. She's experienced. She's nice to small children and their mothers. And she will rape them. And she will be, and there is the fact that she will be the first woman president, blah, blah, blah. And, if that means a great deal to you, no matter who that woman is, I can understand you're voting for her. But the truth is that she's very friendly with corporate giants. I mean, she's locked into them, and she is not going to really push, in my opinion, raising the minimum wage very far, maybe a little bit. And as for foreign policy, she's such a strong believer in empire, it would make Napoleon blush. I mean, it's not enough for her that the United States has 1,000 bases around the world, more than the rest of the world put together. It's really not enough that we get rid of every world leader who doesn't follow our exact orders. I mean, think of Gaddafi in Libya and Saddam Hussein in Iraq and the Democratic elected Manuel Zelaya in Honduras. Good or bad, these leaders made the fatal mistake of not following the exact orders laid down by the United States. And in every case, she either began a rebellion, as she really did in Libya, or she supported a rebellion. And if the United States does not call the shots, if a country doesn't follow our orders, she really follows the the theory that we should invade them, bomb them, and drone them. And, you know, at least she's not a bigot. She's not a fascist in that respect. She doesn't want everyone in the world to look like her if they're going to be approved. I wanted to say about Donald Trump, by the way, that when he says, make America great again, that's code for make America white again. But he really is a deep and aggressive fascist in that regard. So, I mean, if you're not, if you don't look like Donald Trump, and you're not white, and you're not basically right-wing, you'd be foolish to vote for him. In terms of Hillary, I'm worried about her hawkishness. What about you?
Yeah, very much so. I think she's, you know, I refer to the election generally as Mussolini versus Margaret Thatcher. But in all fairness, Hillary, Margaret Thatcher was a terrible homophobe. Very, very anti-gay. And you would never really think that about Hillary Clinton at all. I have to say that in technical terms, she's remarkably competent. She's clearly a brilliant woman with a tremendous intellectual range, of which Donald Trump has zero. I mean, she's very cultured. I have met her, actually. But she's a totally corporate creature. And very, very militaristic. I mean, it's very disturbing.
It is disturbing, but she's not insane. I mean, I really believe that Donald Trump is a psychopath. And, you know, that's, you know, I mean, he's like Caligula. You know, he's like Nero, who fiddled while Rome burned. I mean, he's nuts. So I think you don't really vote for a madman. At least Hillary is sane, and she, with enough pressure, will do some of the right things. But, you know, I had someone on my show, Lauren Steiner, who was a leader in the Bernie Sanders movement here in Los Angeles. And, you know, she said, first of all, in states where they can write in a candidate, that Bernie Sanders has been approved as a write-in candidate in California. And you have to say Bernard Sanders, and you have to mention his, her last name is Goddard. What's her first name? His vice presidential choice. Do you know?
No, I don't, actually.
No, she's the woman
from... I didn't know he had one.
Yeah, from Hawaii, who was so wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Very
nice, very effective woman, very well-spoken and very intelligent.
Well, you have to mention both of them when you write it in.
And, well, the real prize, of course, Lila Garrett, is the Supreme Court and the Senate. I mean, I guess it's possible that Hillary could win. I mean, that Trump could win. I kind of doubt it at this point. I don't think the corporate power structure wants Donald Trump in there. I mean, when you have the Bush family coming out for the Democratic candidate for president, you know that the corporations are on her side. And he's much too destabilizing for the corporate power structure to let him in. The question now becomes, as you know, this is no great Mitzia here, insight is the Senate.
Right.
And she could conceivably, and I'm sorry, and the Senate as it leads to the Supreme Court, she could conceivably make five Supreme Court appointments, because of course the Scalia seat, thank God, is open, and I have read, and I think it's fairly credible that Clarence Thomas will probably resign.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with Scalia gone, he actually has to think for himself, and
think is an oxymoron when it comes to Clarence Thomas. But go ahead.
Yeah, he's really something else. And then, of course, you have Ginsburg, who's very old, and you also have Kennedy and Breyer, who are no spring chickens either.
Right.
And so, really, you could have five appointments for her. And the question is, if she wins, and the odds are pretty high that she will the Democrats have a Senate majority capable of putting Supreme Court justices on? Now, that's something that's really worth fighting for. I mean, the Supreme Court has had a horrendous impact.
Yeah, but you have more faith in her appointments than I do. The Democratic Party, she represents the establishment of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has destroyed almost every progressive candidate that is running for office at this time. Look what they did to Alan Grayson. They pushed in Patrick Murphy, who until 2011 was a Republican. And
Alan Grayson, the progressive who ran for Senate in Florida.
Exactly. I mean, he's magnificent. He got more progressive bills through the Congress than anyone in history, who had a Republican Congress. I mean, he is a remarkable candidate, and they just destroyed him. They destroyed him because they don't really want change. They don't. They want they don't even want, really, Citizens United to be changed. They say they do, but they don't. They want money from the pharmaceutical companies. They want money from the insurance companies. And God knows they want money from the arms companies. So the number one industry in this country is arms. That's our number one export. That's our number one manufacturing product. And that's been true since Reagan. And they don't want to change that. Not really. And that's why they're so cooperative about starting new wars. I was just reading about Mosul. And, and I'm jumping around here, but my show is called Connect the Dots, and there are dots here. You know, and I said, no, this country, all we're talking about is this annoying election that's driving everybody crazy. In Mosul, we have sent 5,000 troops into Mosul. And while the so-called Iraqi army is supposed to be fighting against ISIS, we are also bombing Mosul. So the wholesale murder in Mosul is stunning. Well, we are behind it. And it gets no press. The only thing that gets real press is this election. So what do we do about this, Harvey? It's very frustrating.
Well, it's a nightmare. I mean, all they've utterly destroyed Syria.
Right.
Just absolutely made a horrible mess over there that nobody can figure out who's doing what. It just seems like target practice. You know, and it's horribly tragic. I mean, from what I've read, the city of Aleppo was a beautiful city. And
right.
Just completely arbitrarily mass murdered. And, the Russians are on one side and we're on the other side. And what difference does it make? I mean, and it's all about ISIS, which who knows if it even really exists. I mean, all we know about ISIS is somebody sent a video purporting to be ISIS and beheaded a few people. And all of a sudden, we're spending trillions of dollars to destroy this mythological beast and have completely this leveled an ancient civilization there in Syria. I mean, and she is on one side, and as you and I have discussed, she wants a no-fly zone, which could result in a world war. And suddenly now we're back in the Cold War with Russia. And she, of course, is such a war hawk.
She want a no-fly zone, and I think we should. For those people who aren't familiar with the full meaning of that, and unless you're political junkies like we are, there's no reason why you should be. But, it means that if any country flies over a zone which you have declared is a no-fly zone, their plane can be shot down. Now, you shoot down a Russian plane, what are they going to say? Oh, thanks, we didn't realize it? No. That's war. And again, Trump is right about that. With her, we are liable to start World War III. but he's right for the wrong reasons. He never mentions the no-fly zone because he'll do the same thing. He'll do exactly the same thing. And so between the two of them, I have to say I think she's better. But I have to tell you one last thing, that someone, this Lawrence Diner, who ran the Bernie campaign here in Los Angeles, explained that if Bernie Sanders, just listen to this, if Bernie Sanders wins in Vermont, they have 4 electoral college votes. And if neither Trump nor Hillary managed to get 272 electoral college votes.
I think it's 270.
270. If neither manages to get that, the whole election is brought to the House of Representatives.
Right.
And and they have the ability to pick Bernie Sanders because he was a recognized candidate. Now, would that be the irony of the world? Because to tell you the truth, I know a lot of Republicans who would have voted for Bernie if he had won. And I'm sure you do, too.
Well,
he's
love
not
how
a liar. He stands for something. And he's a reasonable person.
He is a reasonable person. And a smart person. Well, I'm not sure that's going to happen. You never know. It would be very interesting to see if the outcome is that Hillary is elected and that the Democrats do get a majority in the Senate. It's going to be very interesting to see what Bernie does because, you know, he will then be in a really unique position to rally all the progressive forces that he sort of incited. And we'll see what happens. But it's pretty freaky. I mean, I can't imagine, I can't conceive that the powers that be in this country are going to allow Donald Trump to become president. I just don't see that. The question then is really the Supreme Court. And
how are they going to? I mean, if the vote is for Donald Trump, and if you look at his the crowds that he attracts, I mean, their vehemence, their viciousness, you know. Of course, he makes sure that the cameras are pointing in the right direction. I mean, this guy is very camera savvy. But if he's able to mobilize that many people, and there's that much hate in the United States, we didn't realize it. I mean, many people who don't care if 11 million families are broken up. In 11 million families, if the children are ripped out of the arms of their parents and grandparents and deported, it's just that's what Donald Trump wants to do. So you know what's happened, Harvey, in my opinion? Everything in a way has changed. The Democratic Party has become the Republican Party. The Republican Party has become the fascist party. And the overwhelming majority of us who are progressive, really, and not violent. I think that does describe the overwhelming majority of Americans if push came to shove. We have no place to go. So our role now is to come up with a viable third party or to start a viable peace movement. We have all kinds of movements now, environmental movements. We have, gay movements. We have all kinds of movements now. But we don't really have a peace movement. And we're attacking and all over the world. We talk about defending ourselves. Nobody is going to attack us. Nobody.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, man. You know, I'm pretty fearful of those pesky Canadians coming down here and making it. John Simon is with us, by the way. He's going to join us in this conversation in a moment. We're going to talk about stolen elections. Lila, I'll let you go in a minute, but I want to say one thing, first of all, before you disappear, that I am thrilled that the Chicago Cubs defeated the Cleveland Indians for the World Series. It's actually the best World Series game pretty much in history, and I hope that the Cleveland Indians will finally get rid of that sickening and insane logo that they have this picture of a very racist picture of a Native American. I hope they're not one of
right.
They are now the worst. They now have the longest standing drought of any teams for almost 60 years since 1948, since they've won the World Series. So I hope they learned their lesson from this. And when we connect the dots, Laura Garrett, we can talk about that as well. Very, very important, and get rid of that terrible name of a football team in Washington, D.C.
Right.
So along with that, Lyle Garrett, your show at KPFK is Connect the Dots, and I will see you again soon. And,
let me tell you, your listeners how they can log on to it. They can go to kpfk.org. My show goes on from 7 to 8 Monday mornings at specific time. In the East, it's 3 hours later. But you could just go to kpfk.org, log on to Connect the Dots or Lila Garrett, and every show is on for 60 days. So join us.
Wonderful. Well, it's great to have you on, and I'm going to become your neighbor soon, and we'll turn Los Angeles into a solar-topian city. And it'll be great. So I'll have you on, Lila. We'll talk after the election, and we'll assess what's happening. And hopefully Clarence Thomas will be out resigning from the Supreme Court so we can drive in an airstream around the United States. So thank you very much, Lila Garrett, and let's talk again soon.
It was fun.
All right, always. Okay, now we're joined by John Simon. John, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Harvey. Good to be here.
Okay, and you are also in California. Lila Garrett was talking to us from Los Angeles. Where are you?
Bay Area, just north of Santa Cruz, and new here as of the last year, having crossed the country from the other blue state in the east, Massachusetts.
Okay, so now you are author of Code Red about election theft. And I'd like you to comment. You're issuing a new edition of Code Red. The original one came out when?
In 2014, just before the 2014 election.
Okay. And tell us the message of Code Red and what you want to tell people about the possible theft of the 2016 election.
Yeah, well, Code Red pivoted a bit coming into 2016 and this new edition in several ways. One of the key ways is that it still has all the evidence and all the forensics in it, but the thrust of it is more prospective than retrospective. It's looking forward.
Well, talk about
can we bring
program.
In a vote counting system that's observable and that can really earn the trust, of the public, as opposed to just all these false reassurances that we've been hearing lately. So it's more about what we can do going forward to have secure elections and restore public sovereignty.
But it also
deals with what has gone down in 2016 so far in the primaries and what we have to look forward to. It really just came out just as Donald Trump was gearing up his sort of self-serving, scattershot, rigged meme. And so it takes a little bit of that into account, but really is looking forward to what we can do.
Well, tell us the original presumption of 2014 and your 2014 edition of Code Red, and then tell us exactly what you want to say about what's likely to happen in 2016.
Well, the original book, my aim was to be readable and not eye-glazing, so it basically told the story of computerized elections in the United States, starting with the proliferation of them after the Help America Vote Act was passed in 2002. So it talked about why these systems are so vulnerable, how those vulnerabilities were exploited, and also the psychology, how, a public that is known for our, love of democracy and fair play had come to accept a system where votes were counted by computers in the darkness of cyberspace, and the role in that of the media, the role in that of the, you know, desiderata of convenience and entertainment, that we can all go to bed by 10 o'clock knowing who the next president is, knowing the results of elections. You know, there's an enormous trade-off between that convenience and entertainment on the one hand, and the veracity of the elections on the other, and the real foundation of democracy. So it took us through then, you know, the various elections that we've had, and some of the very odd developments, including some of the untimely deaths of people such as Mike Connell, that had a great deal of information about how these machines were being used, how they were being programmed. So, you know, it is unabashedly, in a way, a conspiracy theory, but it's a conspiracy theory that really isn't a theory. It's based on a very, very careful collection and analysis of facts. It just tends to be written off as a conspiracy theory because we are challenging something that is accepted as gospel, which is that we are the beacon of democracy, and therefore our elections couldn't possibly be rigged, as Trump would put it, or in any way manipulated. Going into 2016, I have to say, you know, I think with a lot of people, there's a lot that is mysterious about the last month or so, and it's a very hard call. The one thing we can say is that we're not going to know who actually won, and I'm not just referring to the presidency. I'm referring to state house elections. I'm referring to U.S. House elections, referring to Secretary of State, Attorney General elections. We will not know the winners. And by know, I mean be able to say that counting of votes was an observable process and somebody was keeping an eye on it. Probably 80 to 90% of the counting of votes is taking place absolutely in secret, and only the coders, the programmers of the computers, will really know who actually won.
Well, the critical thing for me from the 2014 election at this point, and we just got off the phone talking with Lyra Garrett from KPFK in California. I've had a lot of discussions with her about this, but the critical moment, I'm going to presume that most likely Hillary Clinton is going to win next Tuesday. The question is, what happens to the U.S. Senate and therefore the Supreme Court? Now, you did a lot of research into the 2014 election. There are three U.S. Senate seats that we think were stolen by the Republicans, which has given them a majority in the Senate and will make it much more difficult for the Democrats to take over the Senate this year. Those elections were in North Carolina, Alaska, and Colorado. Did you, in Code Red, look into these Senate elections, and what do you think about the possibility that they were, in fact, stolen by the Republicans?
I'm sorry to disappoint you on that score, because in the name of trying to keep Code Red readable and fairly linear, that was not treated there, although I have looked at it privately. And, yeah, there's quite a bit of evidence on those three states. And in 2014 in general, what was really outstanding about 2014 was that you had a congressional approval rating that was, by a generous measure, in the single digits. I believe Rasmussen, which is pretty much a Republican polling firm, had an 89% disapproval rating for Congress. And if you remember, you know, the Republicans were in the majority at that point, and they were basically obstructing everything and passing, you know, bill after bill to repeal Obamacare in the House. And so they had control of the Congress, and the Congress had about an 8% approval rating. And so, you know, if ever there was a throw-the-bums-out environment, 2014 was it. That approval rating was historically low. You'd never seen anything like that, and it was consistent from the time the Republicans took over control. In 2010, that approval rating sunk rapidly within months of that election, and then just continued to sink and sink and sink until it really couldn't sink anymore. So you had 8% of the country approving of Congress, and for the first time, a different measure, which said, is your own congressman worthy of reelection? A plurality of people said no. Usually people are down on Congress but up on their own representative. In this case, even in talking about their own representative, it was a 12-point margin by which people said, no, they're not deserving of re-election. Somebody else could do a better job. Okay, so that was the environment. Went into the 2014 election, 222 Republican members of the U.S. House stood for re-election on Election Day, not having resigned or anything else. They were actually on the ballot for re-election. And of those 222, exactly two lost their elections. So it was a re-election rate of over 99% with a congressional approval rate of 8%. This was so illogical. And yes, there's gerrymandering, and yes, there are other influences. Big money was not part of it. The Democrats and Republicans spent approximately the same amount in 2014. A lot of seats were made safe by gerrymandering on both sides. But it could not account for that pattern. It could not account for the significant disparity between the exit poll and the House race, the national vote for the House. There were just absolutely blazing red flags over the House. So that was what I chose to emphasize in Code Red. But yes, the Senate races as well, and some governorship races, and a lot of very suspect state House races, which are, you know, to the average person, so far below the radar. There are no exit polls. Nobody even knows. You know, if you live in let's say, in North Carolina, you probably don't even know who's being elected in your district, let alone in other districts, let alone in Ohio. So these races, you have to be a political operator, basically, an operative, to have an eye on these kind of races. And, of course, that's exactly what we suspect is going on, that there is a war room, and that if not Karl Rove, then somebody very close in kin has targeted the competitive races. And you get results like you did in 2014. Down ballot races are more vulnerable. They're less scrutinized. And the reward is enormous, basically control of the infrastructure in American politics.
Well, what precisely
I hate to, you know, ask such a predictive question here, but what precisely can be done in 2016 save us from this kind of manipulation, if anything? Is it too late?
Yeah, it's basically too late. I mean, it's been too late. I mean, part of the problem with election integrity is that it comes into focus, you know, in the immediate period before an election, where it's too late to actually change any major protocols. And it goes out of focus very shortly after an election. 2004 was an exception where there was a certain prolonged protest or questioning and challenging of those extremely suspicious results. But that's not the norm. The interesting thing in 2016 was that because it was a primary nomination battle that seemed to be targeted, Sanders and Clinton, it was sort of an ongoing, a rolling process. So instead of just being a single day after which all interest faded, interest actually seemed to mount and suspicion seemed to mount as election after election went on, and we saw redshift after redshift. We saw a tremendous disparity between caucus states and primary states, caucus states being, for the most part, hand-counted. And we saw all sorts of overt shenanigans as well, all tending in the same direction, which was to support the Clinton candidacy and to block Sanders. And, you know, can we prove it? I don't know. It depends on what one's standard of proof is. But, you know, in private, we look at it and say, well, yeah, Sanders was blocked. And because it went on from week to week and month to month, it gathered a fair amount of steam in terms of people that were very aggrieved. Many people now that won't vote for Hillary Clinton, even though they, certainly believe that she would be the better candidate relative to Donald Trump, because they are so aggrieved at what was done to Sanders and his candidacy. So, you know, but it's, in terms of stepping up on November 8th, you know, I've advocated civil disobedience. I've advocated going down to precincts and surrounding the optical scanners and requesting politely but firmly that they be opened and that the ballots inside be counted publicly and compared with the machine totals. You know, how much of that is going to happen, I don't know. And the advent of Donald Trump and his vigilantism and thuggery has really given a bad name to election integrity at this point. Unfortunately, we're contaminated with something that's coming from a completely different place in terms of motivation, and it's become very difficult over the last couple of weeks. I mean, as I think you know, in response to Trump's, you know, wild allegations of voter fraud and, you know, meaning people coming in and voting twice or dead people voting or whatever, and potential hacking and all these kind of things, the wagons were circled and everybody came out all up and down the political spectrum with ringing reassurances and endorsements of the safety of our electoral system. I mean, it has now become the wall of denial has become twice as high and twice as thick. So what might have opened the door for election integrity efforts, which would be Trump raising all these suspicions, has also had a very strong counter effect, which is that it's provoked the system into, you know, a kind of blind self-defense, and the truth is getting trampled on all sides.
Astounding. Well, what do you think? Let me put it this way. I'm about to write a piece about the New York Times ran a piece yesterday or 2 days ago about the apparently low voter turnout among black people so far in the early voting. They say Hispanic vote counts are up, the black vote counts are down. Now, am I out of line to say that a logical and likely reason that the vote count among black voters is down is because of the suppressive efforts that the Republicans have been making over the years and Donald Trump's very pointed attacks on you know, hordes of black people coming in and voting three or four times, thereby rigging the election? How credible is it that the black voter turnout so far appears to be down? How is that? Do you believe that's related to the suppression that's been going on?
Yeah, I mean, the voter suppression efforts are manifold, and they run from everything to making it more difficult to register, making it more difficult to actually vote, taking neighborhood by neighborhood and converting polling places and consolidating them, turning them into voter centers to which one might have to drive 5 miles as opposed to walking three blocks. So there are all these structural schemes afoot, some of which are legal, some of which are on, you know, borderline illegal, and the courts have called them on it. But the combined effect of which is to reduce the voting population among minorities, black voters, poor voters, student voters, transients, elderly voters, basically the Democratic constituency. And this has been, you know, Republican strategy for quite some time. They've gotten better and better at it with the advent of big data, because with big data, you can figure out, okay, who are the voters that we really need to target? You can target them more precisely. And on top of which, you now have this thuggery, this mobilization of militias and, Ku Klux Klan has apparently gotten into the act, very much reminiscent of the 1950s or earlier, when the idea was, you know, in the South particularly, to make sure that blacks just were not able to vote. You know, you only have to suppress about in an election as tight as this one, and that goes for, you know, down ballot races as well in many places. I mean, you only have to succeed in suppressing about 10%, let's say, of the black vote or the Hispanic vote to effectively change the result of the election. So they know their numbers, and they know, by they, I mean the Republicans and the operatives, and they have their targets, and I think they're doing a pretty good job of hitting them. It's certainly not the case, I don't think, that black voters are not voting because of Bernie Sanders. They were not Bernie Sanders voters to begin with. They tended to be very much in Clinton's camp. I mean, you can debate why and whether they're deluded in that, but that was, you know, how they've shown up. So I don't think it's, you know, it's voluntary. I do think that the impact of all these voter suppression schemes is being felt. And, you know, you guys wrote the book, Strip and Flip, right?
Right.
You know, that it's both and. You've got to reduce the voting population for your opponent, and then you take care of what's left over covertly inside the machines. You know, you're just facing too much of a margin if you're Republican for only one technique. You've got to do both and we're seeing the voter suppression part. What we won't see directly is the covert part, the vote count manipulation part on these computers that are, you know, operating completely in the darkness of cyberspace. You know, that we won't see. But we can infer its presence from all the various forensic measures that we take, exit poll disparities, cumulative vote share analysis. I mean, you know, we as you know well, we've applied many, many different measures, and we keep coming up with a unidirectional shift in these elections that are competitive and have national significance.
Well, do you think a moderate Republican, a moderate Republican these days, is not a moderate Republican at all, but, for example, John Kasich, well, not even for example, I mean, he's an important figure, would be willing to flip Ohio's electoral votes to Donald Trump? Or is he just going to sit there, or is he going to flip them to Hillary Clinton?
Well, you know, good question there. I think there's a lot going on right now that adumbrates a set of invisible hands. And, you know, we're not flies on the wall. We don't know what's going on in the corridors of power. But certainly the events since the Comey bombshell have a whiff to them that the powers that be have pulled the plug on Hillary Clinton for maybe a variety of reasons. There may be a smoking gun there. There may, in fact, be the fact that she'd be elected straight into an impeachment. There may be the fact that the Democrats were threatening to take over the entire Congress, the Senate and the House, that had to be stopped. It does seem that the tea leaves, you know, reading the tea leaves, I do not believe that a professional like Comey was freelancing in this, that he just went out on his own and said, what the hell, I'm a Republican, I'm going to pull this off. I that would be very surprising to me. So to me, it looks as if there's been the endorsement of whoever from the corporate elites and the political elites that have, you know, say so in these things, that they were going to push the election over to Trump. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all. Now, you know, can you just get in there in the last week and reverse a rig that's been placed or place a rig that hasn't been placed? You know, that begins to get problematic, as you guys found out in Ohio when they're trying to put all the patches in on the machines. It has a kind of visible side to it. Was this all planned, you know, 2 months in advance and the Comey October surprise was just part of it? Again, it's all speculation, and I'm not even sure the historians are ever going to be able to sort it out. There's certain things that just remain concealed. That's what, you know, makes conspiracy theory so such a fun pursuit. I mean, you can speculate on pretty much anything in terms of nefarious and dangerous and ugly human behavior. I think we're in for a very, very, from a progressive standpoint, a very devastating experience next Tuesday night.
Well, John Simon, we're down to our last 2 minutes here. Your book is Code Red, and you've made some pretty dire predictions. I will say that, you know, the idea of this vote stripping
has become pretty mainstream now. People have accepted, you know, a premise that people are being taken off the voter rolls. And now you and others have put the idea that these electronic voting machines have to be gotten rid of. So let's follow that in the future. How do people get your book, John Simon?
Yes, well, first of all, it's Code Red, computerized.
Very quickly.
Yeah,
we're almost out of time.
It's Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. It's available on Amazon.com and also through the website www.codered2016.com. And there's more material there as well, video material and blog material for those who are, you know, interested in boning up on all this.
Okay. Thank you, John Simon. We appreciate it. We'll have you back after the election. Thank you, Otto Garrett, and all you great folks in New York. We'll be back next week for our last post-election show. Take care and see you at the polls.